1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock albums. I'm Red Beard, and today in the studio, the late great David Bowie shares charming stories of his young American years from 1974 to 1978, chronicled beautifully in the box set, Who Can I Be Now?
Because I had this terror in my mind that I was going to be trapped with Ziggy and the Spiders as...
That early?
Oh, yeah. I knew then. And there was no way that I was going to be trapped inside that character as being the rest of my life. But I didn't quite know what I was going to do. I mean, I really sort of painted myself into a corner by finishing Ziggy and the Spiders. And in a way, that is also a freedom, because it meant that I had everything and nothing all at the same time. This is David Bowie in the studio for the making of Young Americans and Station to Station.
More than 40 years ago, all signals were lost from fictitious character Major Tom, the reluctant astronaut in David Bowie's song Space Oddity, who sang to us while floating in a tin can high above the world. You see, in 1975, Bowie abandoned the glam rock he had virtually invented in the guise of Ziggy Stardust, the ego-tripping, tragicomic fallen rock star. That 1972 album, The Rise and Fall of Ziggy Stardust and the Spiders from Mars, would be so highly influential on popular music, fashion, and social attitudes on gender identity that Rolling Stone magazine writers ranked the Ziggy Stardust album at number 35 of all time. First with Ziggy, then his New York blue-eyed soul man, and then the L.A. decadence of his thin white Duke persona, David Bowie was the full moon, irresistibly pulling powerfully, while the rock world was like the tide, following relentlessly, yet always lagging behind. But with Bowie's mid-decade Young American sound pointing toward disco's dominance a mere 2 years later, the tide was coming in quickly. The transitional album, hindsight clearly shows, was 1974's Diamond Dogs.
The period when you've recorded the Diamond Dogs album, you're, I'm told, literally on tour in America, and I don't know if there's you have some downtime or there's a break in the tour. There is a remarkable shift in your approach to everything musical that you're doing then. And it's profound. It's affected popular music ever since you've done it.
I had American music secondhand, like all us English gits. It was on the radio. It was, if we were lucky enough to play a GI bass, then we could buy 45s, or they gave, I had very generous contacts I made there that would give me rock records and R&B and soul stuff that we just couldn't get in England, you know. I mean, the first thing we had to do in England, of course, is, because we had American 45s, is to find the spider to put in the middle, you know, because the...
the little adapter.
Yeah, we had a little thin spider. Spindles, yeah, oh. Yeah. We didn't have the ones that, with the big hole in the middle. So that was the first thing, was finding spiders to play the 45s with. Otherwise, you were standing there trying to get it
line
right
it
on the turntable, yeah, line it up with the rims on the rubber.
I remember like, those days.
Rock
Tramp, I Love You So, sang David Bowie on his 1974 album Diamond Dogs on the great hit Rebel Rebel. For all of the volumes and column inches dedicated to the singular social significance of the 60s decade, David Bowie maintained that it was the 1970s where those lofty ideals were actually given a test drive. Here's a quote that I found to be quite profound. The 70s were the beginning of the 21st century.
Yes.
How so?
Yeah, I really believe that. I think that more than anything else, that the idea of, for me as a member of society, I think for me it felt like an era, a decade when absolutes were breaking down. There was the feeling that things were pluralistic, that the hard and fast rules that we'd sort of, the spin of the 50s where everything was answerable, where there was good, there was bad, there was negative, there was positive, that everything was easy to quantify and easy to put into categories, broke down in the 70s. There was suddenly a feeling that there were at least two sides to every question. There was ambiguity actually became part of society. The whole sexual revolution really reached a point in the 70s where nothing was seen as being quite so clear and straightforward as it was
before.
That's
a good point.
Everything started to, the beginning of the recognition that we live in chaos really started in the 70s. I think the Nixon and the Vietnam conclusion at that point, that the duplicity of what war was all about really came home more than at any other time during that period.
Sure, it came.
It really felt like a new century. The 60s were a coda to the rest of the century. There was like the questions were raised then, I think, in the 60s. But still, there was a kind of an idealism, which in itself had its own absolutes and its own belief that there was an answer to particular things. And I think the 70s showed conclusively that we live on a thread of rationality, then in fact the cosmos is far more complex and non-understandable than we had ever perceived before, that everything we knew was wrong.
That was David Bowie's chilling look into George Orwell's prescient future of 1984 from the Diamond Dogs album 10 years earlier on the calendar. With an estimated 1 million security cameras in just the city of London alone, we are living the new normal today of many of Orwell's dire predictions. David Bowie toured America in 1974 in support of the Diamond Dogs album, but he came back a changed man.
The transition that you made was not subtle. It was overt. It was headline grabbing in the rock press. It had not just a musical component, but it had a personnel component. It had a fashion component, a visual component. You went from rock theater to a much more, shall we say, sparse or musical presentation?
Yeah. That again, was, I still wasn't at a state where I felt comfortable particularly. In fact, any way, shape or form was I comfortable with myself being a performer. I think it comes from, I just had to use characters to portray the songs and the ideas that I had. And I rarely did an album that just was a collection of songs. There was always, even in my mind, a sense of narrative behind the 12 or 14 songs. There was a sense that there was some thematic tie. And I had in my mind characters and a storyline and a city, a location. It was a novella. Each album was an attempt at a novella of some kind. And my need was to portray one of the characters or the protagonist or the lead character in that particular thing on stage to interpret those songs. And it partially became because I enjoy theatrical music. I enjoy the idea of interpreting things on stage and creating an otherness of some kind, creating another kind of world.
Still don't know what I was waiting for. Time is running wild. A million dead in the streets. Every time I thought I got it made, it seemed the taste was not so sweet. Then I turned myself to face me. Ooh, but I never caught a glimpse how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test. As they try to change their worlds. Oh, they're immune to your consultation. They're quite aware of what they're going through.
David Bowie, in the midst of his changes in 1974, on the Diamond Dogs tour, and released as the album David Live, one of the 12 CDs included in this comprehensive box set of Bowie's American years, 1974 through 78, called Who Can I Be Now, and containing the previously unreleased album The Gouster. It's all available now at Amazon. Up next, the sudden death of Ziggy Stardust, and David holds the wake at the top of the charts. I'm Redbeard from In the Studio Archive with the late David Bowie for Young Americans.
This is David Bowie in the studio for the making of Young Americans and Station to Station.
How did you part company with
Mick Ronson and that band, and how did you draft and recruit an entire new band mid-tour, mid-career left turn?
Yeah, let me see. How did that really happen? I think that I just went out on a limb and sunk the whole operation because I had this terror in my mind that I was going to be trapped with Ziggy and the Spiders as...
That early?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I knew then. And there was no way that I was going to be trapped inside that character as being the rest of my life. I have an incredibly short attention span once I've completed something. That was really interesting. I enjoyed doing that a lot, but shouldn't we be moving along now to something else? You know, it's getting a bit tired, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't want to do that.
Extremely.
Mick also wanted, I know, very much to have a career of his own.
Really?
And indeed, he did have a fairly successful career when he first left me with a couple of albums that he made. But I didn't quite know what I was going to do. I didn't know what I would do once I'd done. I mean, I really sort of painted myself into a corner by finishing Ziggy and the Spiders. And in a way, that is also a freedom, because it meant that I had everything and nothing all at the same time. But it made me aware that that really was how I had to deal with things in the future every time, is that once I'd finished with a character, I should finish it and then move on to something else. And it just became a pattern of work right through to the early 80s, when I had virtually stopped. I guess there was a process where I became more comfortable being myself on stage, and the need for characters just became less and less.
Simple, simple, so loud. Leather, leather, everywhere. got to feel. With her old man who can say no more. And with her woman I can suck on the jaw. And with her child I can hope without judging. And with her band that will write before they die. Ain't you proud that you stuck our faces?
Ain't there one damn song that can make me break down and cry?
David Bowie, who as the outrageous gender-bender rock and roll alien Ziggy Stardust had Mick Jagger wearing eyeshadow, Alice Cooper in thigh highs and feather boas, and the New York Dolls forming admittedly as, quote, four David Bowies, that David Bowie comes back from his 1974 U.S. tour as a blue-eyed soul man with chick soul backup singers singing about Soul Train and Afro Sheen.
It was very hard for us to actually perceive that the music that we were listening to was associated with a lifestyle. Very naive, but true. It just came out of space.
Sure it did.
This stuff came from America.
Sure.
Well, all this stuff happened, you know, and America is where... And I think coming to America, the impact of that, this was a real tradition, this was a real music coming from a way of life and a lifestyle, actually really came home in full force. And I got completely and overwhelmed by it, as I usually do by new things, or new experiences, not new things by any means, but new experiences. And I was just swept away with it. And I wanted to soak it up and then express it my way. Which is generally what I kind of find that I do, you know, with enthusiasms. They all go in and then they all come out from the point of view of a kid from South London. So that's sort of in a nutshell is what happens, I think. Oh, I tell you what else was so important to me. So important to me is that when I first got to New York, I linked up pretty immediately. They joined the Spiders temporarily. Actually, it's not quite true. Carlos never actually joined in immediately. Mike Garson and shortly after him, Carlos Alomar were two of the people that I met when I first got to New York. And Carlos used to take me up and downtown. And I started going regularly 2-3 times a week with him to the Apollo because Carlos was in the house band there. And I used to get to see everybody. I cannot tell you, from around 1970... must have been about 1972, late 72, right through to 74. I must have seen every act that ever played at the Apollo.
You know, I hate you.
And you don't know the impression. Well, you must know the impression that that whole experience made on me.
Oh.
And I had a cool time. I had such a cool time because I looked like nothing that America had ever seen before.
Particularly at the Apollo.
At the Apollo. I look quite out of place. But you know what? I had some of the greatest times of my life there. It was just fantastic.
Wow.
It was so cool.
Wow.
From the Spinners on up and down, it was wonderful. I saw Cuba's father working in Carlos's band, of course. It was, oh my God, what were they called? Blue. Damn it. I can't remember the name. It was just wonderful. It was a wonderful experience. So that we'd only ever gotten a taste of those acts back in Britain. We occasionally saw things when they came to town. It may be once every year or something. Something fantastic would come to town. I remember seeing Sam Cooke on stage in London, and that was just like unreal experience. I mean, it was just fantastic. You only ever heard them on the radio, or you know, had the records. And the live experience is always the thing that kind of really solidifies you. If it's a music you're gonna like or not gonna like, you'll know once you've seen it live, and zing, you're gone. You know, they were very good days, I must say.
Mm.
Boy, did I have some fun in those days.
Who are some of your favorite falsetto singers? Break down and cry.
Yeah, I'm just trying to remember who.
Let me throw a few out there. Al Green, Smokey.
Oh, but of course, Al Green.
Eddie.
No, I think Al Green. Eddie Kendricks.
Eddie Kendricks.
Yeah.
You know who Mick says that he copped his falsetto directly from was Don Covey. Do you remember Don Covey?
Cecil. Absolutely, I remember Don Covey. Yeah, there are any number of bands that I really used to go crazy about. Mick was more purist. His thing was much more the blues and city R&B. I mean, I sort of opened up to things like the Contours and bands like that.
So with Carlos, he was showing you around. He was taking you to the real deal.
And also he used to take me to places like the Leopard and all the Latin clubs, which was, of course, part of his background. And so I used to learn all the moves and all that and just watch the kids. Cause on Wednesday nights was talent night. And kids would they would rehearse all week. And they come up and they used to dress very, very smart. You had to dress very, very smart at the Leopard. Tie, shirt and all that. And then they was like 13 and 14 year old couples would come out and just dance like you've never seen, just like ripping the floor up. And they get, you know, a little prize at the end of the night. But Tito Puente and whatever would be playing and stuff. Like
cool.
That. It was great.
Cool. I have always had a soft spot in my heart for you in that period because you turned me on the David Live and stuff like that. You turned me on to David Sanborn.
Oh, yeah.
How did you find him?
I think it must have been a recommendation from Carlos. You know, we needed a horn player to work on the new material. And I think he probably hauled in David from... I think David was pretty much doing piecemeal work in those days. He wasn't working too hard. He was virtually undiscovered.
Yes, he was.
I mean, heavens...
But you were a horn man. What did you hear in his work that
well, interestingly enough, it's the one thing that I really admired as much as his the frequent homage playing to, say, King Curtis, who was probably my absolute major sax player. I thought Curtis was just it.
Really?
And David kind of came so close at times to his style of playing. But it was the fact that David was really open to using it, electronic equipment to distort and change his sound. And I just thought, I had in my mind that there must be a way of working with the sax and kind of work in the same area that Hendrix did with guitar playing.
Wow.
And I really tried to encourage David to get more and more involved in that. And it was, in a way, I still love David. I think it works wonderfully. I kind of think he could have gone in so many different directions and taken some different avenues.
I am moved. Had the plan I had to use. It's so divine. The soul shines and breaks the night too tight. Ever loving face.
Somebody Up There Likes Me features a then-unknown David Sanborn just blowing his brains out on saxophone on the unreleased album that David Bowie recorded at Sigma Sound Studio in Philadelphia that David called The Gouster. Sigma Sound's personnel were responsible for a string of hits produced by Kenny Gamble and Leon Huff for the OJs, Harold Melvin and the Blue Notes, Billy Paul, and Teddy Pendergrass.
You turned me on to David Sanborn, who helped me discover modern jazz and jazz fusion. And
yeah.
And I will always be indebted to you for that because
wow.
you brought that into my...
That's so cool.
See, you brought that into my musical palette that wasn't there before. I would have stopped with, you know, Motown and...
But that's interesting. When I was very young, when I first got a saxophone, I wanted to be Jerry Mulligan.
Ah.
That was the guy. Because
yeah.
One, he was white, and two, he had a fabulous haircut. And when you're 14, that's like
that's
really great. Important, you know? Oh, yeah, and he also played really good sax. But I thought, this guy is playing there. He's out there playing that music, you know? And I could do that.
I could do that.
Well, before that, in fact, it was going to be, I was going to be, when I was really, the first time I ever saw a saxophone, I thought, I'm going to buy one of those and join the Little Richard Band. That's what I'll be when I grow up. Because he was the first artist that really
did it for me. You would have looked like a fluorescent light bulb. A fluorescent light bulb vertically on stage. Can you imagine?
Richard was fantastic. And when I saw that sax lineup that he had, I thought, my God, I want to play one of those. That looks so cool. And then one of the guys stood up on the piano and played a solo. I thought, that's great. That's what I could do for a living. Stand on a piano. And dress in those really cool mohair suits. This is the life. I don't have to be in an office. It was interesting. I never met Richard until many, many, many years later. And I think probably of any artist at all, he's probably the one that really absolutely convinced that music would be my life, you know. I mean, when I would just have a wind-up record player, and it was all 78s in those days, and I used to have... wonder what they were on in those days. London American, I think, was the label that he was on in Britain. And he's on Specialty over here.
Specialty, right.
I've actually got all the Specialty 78s.
Wow.
Those are the first things I bought when I came to the States, were all Little Richard's 78s from secondhand shops.
Good investment.
Oh, yeah.
Nice buy.
Oh. And I think just sort of winding that thing up and playing his music, really in a household that didn't particularly like anything loud, you know, it was... Again, it was my music. It didn't belong to anybody else. It was just something that represented me. And again, it's that elitist thing again, you know. This represents me, and it's not part of the rest of the world.
Still to come, David Bowie gets an impromptu visit in the studio by John Lennon, and their combined fame lands at number one. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, at Redbeard Rocks on Twitter, and online anytime at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, focusing on David Bowie's Young American Years from 1974 to 78 in the box set Who Can I Be Now?
Thanks for rejoining us in the studio. David Bowie here with Redbeard.
But I've never heard the particulars of how you composed Fame with John Lennon.
I kind of gotten to know John around that period. I think that was the beginnings of our... relationship, in as much that we just bumped into each other quite a few times and had gotten drunk a few times and spent a few nights out and all that. And he came to the studio in my absence, I think. I didn't get in till about an hour later. I didn't know he turned up. He and Carlos were fooling around with a riff that Carlos had pulled out of the bag for an earlier song that we used to do on stage called Foot Stomping by the Flares. I don't know if you remember that.
No.
It was the on the B side of that was I Wish I Could Shimmy Like My Sister Kate.
That I've heard.
But not the Flares version.
No, not the Flares version.
And so Carlos was using that riff as the foundation of this thing that we did called Foot Stomping. Everybody young and old learns how to rock and roll. Foot stomping. You don't know that?
I do now.
Anybody know that one? Nobody knows Foot Stomping.
I like that, though.
Flares were cool. I think they only had two singles. They were really good. They were like the Contours, you know, it was okay. Like that kind of period of song. And so Carlos had ripped that one off and was kind of playing it in the studio. Then I came in, I don't know, it just pulled together really quickly after that. It was a really, really fast session. There's not much to it. Now, in the background, on one of the lines, John was singing, "Aim." And that was basically the substance. That was John's minimalist but incredibly important contribution to the song.
That's funny.
And he also wrote the three chords in the front on the piano that we then turned around backwards and played the bass. We'll be right back.
David Bowie's sole number one U.S. hit was Fame from the Young Americans album.
It was just a joy to work with anything with him, you know. It was he was such a great guy to be with. He was so inspirational, so kind of, I don't know, actively alive. I mean, his brain was just working at full speed all the time. You know, nothing. He didn't miss a trick. He was witty. He was smart. He was just a cool guy. Very, very cool guy. I think that probably one of the most interesting people to talk, not that I agreed with everything he said, I must say, but one of the most interesting guys to talk to, other than from the same generation at least, maybe Pete Townsend. Pete Pete's got a wonderful mind.
He does.
He's a terrific guy.
He is a wonderful conversationalist.
I like him a lot.
Me
He's
too.
A terrific guy.
Me too.
Yeah.
Was this during John's kind of the house husband New York City days?
Let me see now. What can I say these days? Yeah, I guess. I think at the time he was probably, I think he was going out with May Pang at the time. It was that period, you know. He was up and down. I mean, there was a lot going on in his life, I think. But I think there was a lot going in both of our lives. So we spent an awful lot of time talking about that stuff. But on the whole, he was a very buoyant person. I didn't get the impression at any time that I was with him that there was anything kind of, you know, depressive about him. He kind of, it's just that the sense of humor was his salvation. He just, everything he could make light of, not make light of maybe, but has some quite pithy observations about what was going down, you know.
And rapier wit.
And that would just make himself laugh, you know, and said, you know, I don't believe this, you know. It was great.
Next week at the same day and time, we'll explore the rest of David Bowie's U.S. years between 74 and 78 when he sheds his blue-eyed soul persona for Life in the Fast Lane of Hollywood 1976 and the Station to Station album. It's one of 12 CDs or 13 vinyl records in the Who Can I Be Now brick, which includes the unreleased David Bowie album The Gouster, available now at Amazon. I'm Redbeard, back in the studio after this.